Glenn Kimball has a BA in journalism and MA in communications. In addition, he has successfully completed all coursework for a PhD in communications, passed his doctoral exams. He does not. He's lacking his dissertation. He was the former president of International Exchange School and the vice president of two cellular phone companies. Glenn has taught school at Southern Illinois University and was ranked by student evaluations in the top 10 instructors at the university. He's been collecting ancient texts since the age of 15 and is famous for being able to integrate very diverse texts into a very contiguous storyline. Glenn, welcome to Coast, my first time talking to you. How are you?
It's a great pleasure to be with you, George.
Likewise, too. I hail from St. Louis, very close to where you were down there. You were either at, what, Carbondale or Edwardsville, I would guess.
I was at Carbondale.
Okay, great school, by the way.
A marvelous school.
Except they were known for some Halloween pranks, huh?
They were known for a great deal more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those days...
It exceeded our vocabulary.
Yeah, they got out of hand sometimes, didn't they?
They closed the town down during one season of the year to keep it under control, and that was perennial, by the way.
Well, get the dissertation done so I can call you doctor next time you're on, huh?
Well, we are working on that.
Okay, good for you. Let me ask you, there's so many things I want to talk with you about today, Glenn. But first of all, because this is my first opportunity of chatting with you, tell me a little bit about you. And we've got new listeners that come on all the time. They don't know a lot about you. Just give me a little bit of your background beyond what I just mentioned.
Well, you know, my father was a Greek historian, and I was a predisposition to be an athlete. Loved the baseball and the football and all the things the kids did, but my father would never throw a baseball to me on the lawn. And as a result, the communication gap between us grew wider and wider as I grew into my teen years. And I found the secret to communicating with my father, whom I dearly loved, and he's passed on now 5 years, was to get involved in what he was interested in. And so he was interested in Greek history,
uh-huh.
Ancient texts. And so I began reading them and collecting them as a child. I was a great baseball card collector, and so I thought, well, geez, collect ancient texts and you'll have a collection when you get older. and I found out that there were hundreds of thousands of these things. And as a matter of fact, it is my estimate that there are 5 million ancient texts dealing with Christ, his apostles, and his associates.
5 million?
That survive in our day-to-day. It's astounding.
And I bet it crosses all religions, too, doesn't it?
It most certainly does. It goes from coast to coast in our country, all the way into Europe, all the way into Asia. Certainly, you know, one of the miracles of this radio program and what you provided for your listeners is that on your site, coasttocoastam.com, there are listed three precious manuscripts that survive in our day that were preserved in the East, in China and Tibet. These were writings of Jesus, his teachings, and the mission of his little brother in the East. Things we think that our Bible should contain the writings of Jesus, but it contains not a single one. And yet the East preserves many of them, and several of the most prominent are listed on Coast to Coast AM tonight. Absolutely precious documents that will thrill those who are great fans of Jesus the character.
Well, and you know, as we are only a few weeks away from Easter, it's only fitting to talk about Jesus as a prophet and who he is and why so many different kinds of religions mentioned this individual and just who he was. Before we get into that, tell me a little bit also about this cave. I've been getting hundreds of emails from people who want you to give us an update about this cave.
Everyone wants us to open the door and tell us what's inside. You know, it takes sometimes years to open up an archaeological site. There are political considerations. In this country, there are laws. And in our particular case, there have been very sweet and dear owners of the property who, our particular site is located in one of the last virgin oak groves in America. And to destroy that stand of trees or to disturb that ground would have been sacrilege for me and certainly for Wayne May. And in addition, the owner of the property has had a serious illness and subsequently died. And the subsequent probate, et cetera, has delayed us for almost 2 years. However, encouraging news is on the horizon. I hate to even talk about it on the air, because what will happen is we will get 10,000 people who want to help, and what we really need is for everyone not to help. The last time we had help, you know, I needed to poke myself in the eye. The kind of help we got. But I can't speak for Russell Burroughs, because this site is not really... Russell would deny that this particular site is his site, though he was the one who led Wayne there originally and suggested that this was his site, and then later turned around and said, I lied to you, or I did not tell you the truth, or however he wanted to term that. And he said that his site is somewhere else. And so I will not speak officially of what he does and what he did.
Well, how many sites are we talking about?
Well, to be honest with you, there's a labyrinth of caves all the way through Illinois.
Right. Oh, yeah. I know that.
Our site, we've done ground-penetrating radar surveys of the site, and they suspiciously match the original Burroughs Cave maps. I mean, they are the same shape. So it's our contention that regardless of whether this is the original Burroughs Cave or not, we have a very, very strong probability that there are not only... that this is not only of ancient significance, but that there are actual artifacts inside this cave. On the last time we were on Coast to Coast, we showed some of the ground-penetrating radar images that we took from the surface, and one of them looks suspiciously like the statue of the hands outstretched of a figure. And certainly we found that the images of some suspiciously looking sarcophaguses that were in there. And it's also our thought that there are probably ancient texts. You know, in Illinois and Indiana, Midwest entirely, there has been, over the last 300 years, a serious underground black market in ancient artifacts.
Oh, of course. That's worldwide, isn't it?
Well, it is worldwide. As a matter of fact, in Iraq, you know, we speak of Iraq, prior to the onslaught of the necessity of oil in the world, the leading commodity of Iraq, export of from Iraq, was in fact artifacts.
With most of them in German museums right now, I believe.
Without any doubt, yeah. And some of those were very, very serious artifacts, and many of them went into private collections, which is the greatest tragedy in the world, because people think that by putting it in a private collection that they are preserving it for posterity, and their kids get it in a probate will. And they go, what's this? And I don't like that. And they throw in the trash. You know, they have no clue
what it is,
what their parents have collected. You know, and that's sad indeed. Paintings and on the list goes. And as a matter of fact, of the original artifacts from the original Burroughs site, most of those have gone underground and are trafficked widely throughout the Midwest.
Well, who do you think made these artifacts? Native Americans, or are we talking about way back?
I have handled upward to 1,000 of them myself, and the images that they portray look to me like they are of the Moorish sailors from the first century A.D. There are also images of Judeo-Christian origin. On many of them are the symbol of God. Certainly, we found several of them that have man hanging on cross, which was definitely a Roman, exclusively
right.
A Roman image. We have beheadings and temples and migrations and maps and all kinds of things on these artifacts. But if you were to ask me where they came from or what the dating of the artifacts would, the earliest ones would be from around the first century.
First century. I wonder if Christopher Columbus knew that, huh?
Well, Christopher Columbus definitely had a map to discover the Americas. We know that. You know, the Friar's Map, written by my great friend Gunnar Thompson, has published the map that Christopher Columbus had on his boat to discover the Americas, and on that map was the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the word America, this is very interesting, and the first time this has ever been on Coast to Coast, we look at the name America. Most historians who are naive would suggest that the name America came in the namesake of Amerigo Vespucci, who came after Christopher Columbus within a decade and explored North and South America. But Amerigo Vespucci is masculine. America is feminine. And even if you look at the word country in Spanish or Latin, it is masculine. So why in the world are we calling the Americas after a feminine America? That tradition goes way back into Western Europe. We know that King Arthur, the legends of King Arthur were that he had his treasure in the West. And if you go to Mount Tor, where supposedly Avalon is today, west of Avalon is the Atlantic Ocean. You know? But he said his treasure was beneath the constellation of the Americas, or Las Estrellas, which is the stars in Spanish, is feminine. So the Americas were definitely not named after Amerigo Vespucci, and many of the most serious scholars in history realized that Amerigo Vespucci had nothing to do with calling the Americas the Americas. Certainly the name Americas came from the more ancient text describing a constellation of stars, which was in fact named the Americas.
Fascinating.
And they obviously had explored. We know that King Arthur, too, was killed in the Americas. We know that because we have paintings and writings and the great Holy Kingdom book that was researched.
What year would that have been, Glenn?
That painting would have been around the year 700 A.D. And it hangs, the frescoes hang in the Stoke Dry Cathedral to this day. They depict Native American Indians shooting arrows into the great King Arthur II, which was a descendant of the original king.
The original one, yeah.
Yeah. And so how in the world does King Arthur II get shot with American Indian arrows and have such a wide variety of frescoes and paintings depicting him having returned from the sea, being executed by Native American Indian types? You know, it's just too coincidental. And certainly one of the reasons why the King Arthur's entourage was so wealthy was that they had gold. Certainly they did not mine gold in Great Britain. Great Britain is not known for its gold mines. It's known for its tin and lead and its coal, but it's not known for its gold mines.
Yeah, they don't have the gold there.
No, they claim themselves in their records that they got their gold from the West, or Avalon, or beneath the Americas. And certainly there's evidence all the way back to 3000 B.C. in Michigan, which are copper mines up in Wisconsin and Michigan, where there was mining done, and the Native American Indians to this day tell us that strangers from the East came and did the mining, took the yellow metal out and shipped it down the Mississippi or out through the Great Lakes and took it eastbound. We know that all of the, if we look in Europe during the Bronze Age, there are not copper mines sufficient to have supplied all the copper necessary for all of the warfare weapons and other uses of copper in Europe and Asia. They had to have gotten it somewhere else, and certainly those copper mines, the only dated ones that I am aware of that were large enough to provide that kind of a metal, were up in Michigan and Wisconsin area.
And they must have had thousands of people here mining and doing whatever they had to do in order to get that material back.
Without any doubt. And, you know, I have to laugh because one of the things that we've discovered in our day, they've done a survey of Egyptian sarcophaguses and done a toxicology report on the nine most famous Egyptian mummies in Germany. Toxicology means they take a sample of the hair to determine what was the diet and what kind of drugs they may have been using, etc. Every single one of them from 2,500 years B.C. had cocaine in their hair. Every one of them did.
All right, but what does that tell you?
There's only one place in the world where cocaine is grown. They've done an herbological survey in Africa to see if the cocaine came from Africa. It did not.
It came from South America, didn't it?
It came from Peru.
Yep.
And so, in other words, the Egyptians were trafficking in drugs as far back as the building of the Giza Plateau pyramids, Khufu's pyramid himself, in cocaine. And they've done surveys on other sarcophaguses, and some 70 to 90% of them also had cocaine in their hair. And by the way, the majority of them also were embalmed with tobacco, which was not grown in Europe or Asia.
So you're saying that they could have been here 5,000, actually now 7,000 years ago. Maybe even more.
There's little doubt that they were. There's little doubt that they were. The Americas were a strange place, and I'll tell you one of the reasons why it's not more known. There's two reasons, first of all. When Pizarro came over to the Americas, there were 50 million Native American Indians in the Amazon basin. If you fly over, I used to live in Bolivia, for example. You fly over the Amazon, and you look down, and you find these huge open areas where there's obviously agricultural development right in the middle of the jungle.
Right.
And if you go to places like Cochabamba in Peru, or Trinidad in Bolivia, Cochabamba in Bolivia and Trinidad in Bolivia, both of them, you'll find out that there are over 250,000 meters of hand-dug canals through the Amazon basin. You couldn't walk through these jungles, but you could take boat rides through these man-made canals. There were 50 million Indians that were eventually killed by diseases, not by Pizarro's men. And so there were a lot of people here. But in addition, the Americas suffered a plague that the Europe did not suffer. We suffer from tornadoes. We suffer from more earthquakes. Natural disasters are more prevalent here than they ever were in Europe. And there were massive numbers of historical disasters here in the West that did not take place in Europe or in Asia. And so there were whole civilizations that were periodically wiped out here in the Americas.
Just gone all of a sudden.
Yeah, you look in the bottom of Lake Titicaca, there are still cities down there. That's in Bolivia on the border with Peru. There are still cities at the bottom of that lake, and I lived in Juliaca right on the shore. And no one's ever discovered them. No one's ever excavated them. There are cities right off the coast of Lima, Peru, and the ancient canals from the mountains going down into the ocean, instead of running down into the ocean, they now go upward. So the mountains have been rising about 11 inches a year, where in California, for example, they might raise a fraction of an inch a year. The Andes Mountains are severely changing at this moment. There are huge civilizations that have gone. When I was living in Peru in 1970, there was an earthquake that killed 50,000 people, and I was standing right in the middle of that.
Oh, my, yeah.
And there was an entire towns that were wiped out, and where you couldn't even see a brick. There was not any evidence whatsoever that a town had ever been there.
Just demolished.
Just
gone.
Demolished, buried, sunken into the earth. The only thing that was left was the statue of Christ on the hill with his arms now stretched into nothingness.
Well, why doesn't the modern history, Glenn, teach some of this or at least try to investigate it outside of a handful of people like yourself that try to dig for what you think might be a different interpretation of ancient history?
Well, I can give you an illustration of the problem. The last two major documentaries done on Pizarro and Peru were done by British film crews. The greatest documentaries done on British history were done by American film crews. We don't like our own history. We are people who bury our own history, burn our own books, and think we must have an inferiority complex. And if, you know, Gunnar Thompson tells me that he tried to get his books published dealing with the discovery of the Americas, the Friar's Map, for example, and he could not get one historical journal to accept any of his manuscripts, not because he wasn't a scholar or a PhD, but because they, by definition, would not take a manuscript that dealt with anything before 1492. In other words, by definition, we have institutionalized that part of history out of existence.
Well, and as you know, even like Cahokia Mounds, which you're very familiar with, about the very ancient Indian civilization, we have still failed to do an in-depth study on what might be in those mounds.
Well, they drilled them. We know they went down 40 feet, and they found rock pyramids underneath them in the last year or so.
And then they just stopped doing whatever they did.
Yep.
Stay with us. My guest is Glenn Kimball. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with my guest, Glenn Kimball. And you can also get two of Glenn's websites. They're already hooked up with mine, coasttocoastam.com. Just go take a look at some of those. And fascinating reading. And we're going to get into some of these ancient texts, which have always interested me for just a number of years. Glenn, the cave again, the main entrance to the cave. I guess you don't want to tell the world where it is, do you?
It's in Illinois.
Oh, yeah, I knew that. I probably know the area.
I guarantee you would be very familiar with it, George. You and I would go down there, and it would be totally old home week.
Well, is everything taken out of it, or are things still in there?
No, there are definitely artifacts still in there. We can tell by our ground-penetrating radar, you can see them. I mean, there are artifacts that are large enough to be able to be detectable from the surface.
Ah.
That's what's so scary wonderful about this thing, is that you can tell from the surface. But, you know, caves are no stranger to Illinois.
No, they've got them all over the place. And they also have coal mines out there, too, don't they?
Oh yes, of course. Yeah. Most of them were strip mines, but there are underground mines as well. But the natural occurring caves, you know, it amazes me because there are people, there are historians that believe that the original Garden of Eden was not in Iraq between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. There are historians that believe that it was here in the Americas.
I have heard that theory before.
And you know what? What's interesting is because the ancient text that survives in Egypt to this very day and comes, it's probably the oldest text we have in the world. It's called the Book of Adam and Eve. That book, that ancient text, talks about that when Adam left the west gate of the Garden of Eden, he was commanded to take Eve and be housed in the Cave of the Treasures. In other words, this cave was beneath the Garden of Eden. And Iraq does not have the caves.
No, they do now.
Well, maybe so.
They're man-made.
Well, we got to be careful because there may be biological weapons down there. But there's no biological weapons in the caves in Illinois, I can promise you that. But
no, that's true.
But the interesting parallels between the Cave of the Treasures and what exists in Illinois and Indiana makes me very suspicious that maybe some of the scholars are correct that it might have been in the west and not in the east. And if you notice, we do have the Ohio and Mississippi that kind of form a little T there,
mm-hmm.
that kind of act like the rivers east and west.
A lot of similarities.
And also it says in the Book of Adam and Eve that what comes to us in Arabic, by the way, from Egypt, said that there was a sea to the north. Now, there's not an ocean, but there certainly are the Great Lakes to the north.
Well, and also the lush vegetation that is in that area in Illinois.
And also the worship, the Native American Indians have worshipped this ground. The Mississippi Valley is riddled with thousands, it used to be anyway, with thousands of burial mounds and temple plateaus that were built in this area for worship of the Native American Indians.
So when do you think you can update me on the cave? How long do you think it'll be?
I'm going to leave that for Wayne. It's not as far away as you think. There will be an update. Every time I've given an update, I've had to eat my words. And it hasn't been my fault. There have been political problems and obviously illness involved in this thing, and I've been back three times and been disappointed three times that we were not able to.
I understand. Even 2001 in September was going to be a planned trip, was it not?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, and I can understand that one.
And I spent 3 weeks back there, and I realized that the problem wasn't anybody's fault. They were the good people that were involved all the way across the map there in this excavation. We just had a problem. We had a problem with illness and harvests, and there was corn crop harvest. The people that own this property have extensive holdings there, and I think they were reluctant to disturb this pristine oak grove.
Well, that's possible.
And you know, when it rains back there or snows, it gets to be mud up to your neck, you know. And you bring big caterpillars into that kind of a forest, and you'd scar for life. And certainly Illinois is the land of scarred earth with the surface mining that has been going on.
And I'm sure, too, there are lots of people that want to get their mitts on some of the some of those artifacts.
Oh, I get. There are bandits everywhere.
Yeah.
And the security of the property is another thing that was a consideration on one of the trips I went back. There just wasn't enough security. So
I mean, is there an armed guard out there or anything like that?
Not at this point. It doesn't need to be. There will need to be at some very soon point
in
time.
Yeah, I would think so. Okay, so we'll make sure we get updated on that situation
when
it happens. And by the way, there is a website that Glenn has given us that is attached, again, to coasttocoastam.com, and that's ancientamerican.com, which you can get a little bit more information on that Illinois site, that cave site, if you want to take a look at that.
That's correct. The Ancient American magazine is fascinating because it is chock full of evidence of pre-Columbian visitors to the Americas.
I think that's just incredible stories.
Yes.
They really are. But the stories that are also incredible, Glenn, are what you have also been investigating for a number of years now, and that has to do with ancient texts that all seem to channel into some similar things as well. And, you know, the name Jesus to some people, I don't want them at home to go, oh, no, he's going to have a religious show. And
that is not true.
That's not what we're talking about tonight, is it?
We're going to talk about the politics of this culture, this mystical movement, which is far more interesting, at least at this point. I really encourage people in their beliefs, but that's not what we're going to deal with tonight. We're going to deal with the political situation, what actually happened, the historical nature of it. Jesus is the one character in all history that transcends all five major religions and histories, by the way. The histories of all five major religions.
Well, let's clear this up now. You do believe that there was a human being who was born, and he was called Jesus.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It would be silliness for anyone to deny that. We have too much archaeology. We have too much writing evidence. We have too much cross-cultural, multi-dimensional, multifaceted rhetorical evidence and archaeological, anthropological. We have evidence coming out our ears that this gentleman exists, including Roman records, excluding Josephus.
Mm-hmm.
Josephus was the traitorous rat that cost a million people his lives and only mentioned Jesus peripherally. But you had to remember that when Josephus wrote his text, he had already betrayed his people and was writing his histories in the halls of the Roman as the adopted son of Caesar. And in those days, if you admitted you were a Christian three times, you got a visit to the lions in the Colosseum. So you just didn't talk about Jesus.
What happens if you only admitted it twice?
Well, Titus in 101 A.D., institutionalized the law that you could not send a person to the Colosseums for being a Christian unless they admitted it three times. If they only admitted it twice, you could not send them. And you have to ask, why in the world would they have a law saying if you only confessed once, you could not be sent to the lions? And the reason is because the Romans were predispositioned fans of Jesus, including Tiberius Caesar, who knew Jesus personally, knew his little brother. Tiberius Caesar called them his little twins, Jesus and Thomas. That is recorded not by me. It's recorded by a Harvard professor, Raymond E. Brown. You know that little school, Harvard, in Boston?
Oh, yes.
That obscure school and the obscure professors there that know nothing, you know. That's not true. These men are brilliant. Raymond E. Brown was the foremost historian in this field in our day, in the last 100 years, and he tells us that Tiberius Caesar knew Jesus personally.
Okay. Now, so we all agree, and I always have, that Jesus was a human being. Let's not debate right now the merits of who the man was, not yet at least. However, almost every religion says that the man was a prophet, right?
At least a prophet, and certainly we take them one at a time just briefly so we can review. Obviously, Christians believe him to be the Messiah. However, the Christians are probably the most guilty of burying the text written by and about Christ. They hold up the Bible and say everything else is to be excluded. And frankly, the Christians are the largest culprits for burning books and hiding the true history of what Jesus did, said, and went, and all those sorts of things.
Tell me more about that.
Well, Christians, when all the way back to the Maccabean movement in the 4th century B.C., the Jews had lost their scriptures. They literally had lost the Old Testament. They retained the five books of Moses, but the rest of it was all gone. So by the time of 68 B.C., they had to send a delegation of seven priests from each of the tribes of Israel to Alexandria, Egypt, to retrieve the Old Testament, because they didn't have it.
What happened?
They were book burners. They were in so much turmoil back before the life for 300 years that they and so much conflict between the various libraries and various factions of Judaism for 300 years that they burnt their books. They burned each other's books.
Well, let me ask you this, Glenn, because this is something I've always wanted someone to answer for me. When we talk about the fact that they had a text or a book that they wrote, probably on the papyrus or whatever they used at the time, did they have more than one copy? I mean, did they make up two of them or three of them or four of them of the same thing?
Certainly they did. And by the way, there were multiple versions preserved by multiple cultures in varying libraries. You know, we have to thank Alexander the Great for institutionalizing the library process in Egypt 300 years, or more than 300 years before the birth of Christ. In fact, he became the first of the Ptolemy pharaohs, of which there were 10. And by the time of Cleopatra, her little brother Ptolemy the 10th was the last of the pharaohs. But you notice that 9 out of those 10 pharaohs couldn't even speak Egyptian. The only person that could speak Egyptian out of those 10 people was Cleopatra.
Yeah, that's true.
And so they institutionalized the libraries in Alexandria, Egypt, and we think that Egypt was the only one that had a library? No, the Greeks had a great library. They were the ones that invented the library system. So the Greeks had a library, the Egyptians had a library, and to be honest with you, there were two excellent additional libraries. There was a library preserved by the Buddhists in the East. Their library was far more extensive than that of the West.
I bet theirs was pretty darn metaphysical, wasn't it?
Oh, it was fabulous. In fact, they have more writings of Jesus and about Jesus than we do. And when Chief Justice Douglas of the Supreme Court went some years ago back to Tibet and spoke to the Grand Lama looked him square in the eyes and said, "We own your Jesus."
We own your Jesus, huh?
We own your Jesus. And Chief Justice Douglas said, "What? Are you kidding me?" And the evidence of that fact, that they did own the Jesus, at least in terms of writings, is on the Coast to Coast AM site tonight.
Yes, it is.
Three of the manuscripts that were preserved in the East have survived in our day and are wonderful additions to certainly Christianity. If you want to hear what Jesus taught, if you're a fan of his teachings, you certainly must get on that site and look at the possibility of getting those texts. So,
well, how did they know, Glenn, what his teachings were unless he was there?
He certainly did travel, and you know, we have to back up and say, why in the world did he travel? How did he get to this traveling mode?
And what period are we talking about?
And what period are we talking about? Well, Jesus, his father, Joseph, who was married to the Virgin Mary, was really not a carpenter. That's a mistranslation. He was really more of a stonemason. And if you look to the north at the time of Jesus' birth, they were building the city of Caesarea. Caesar was building a city to himself there in northern, near Galilee. And certainly Joseph was a part of that. And Joseph wasn't just a worker pounding nails. He was one of the stonemasons par excellence and one of the carpenters par excellence. There's a text surviving in our day where Joseph actually was the one who carved the throne that Caesar was to sit on when he came into Jerusalem.
So he was a laborer, though.
Well, he was an artisan.
Okay.
But when he died, see, there is also a record called the Serapion document, which Jesus wrote, by the way. Oh, my gosh, you mean Jesus wrote a book? He wrote a book called the Serapion document, which talks about his own father's death. And so Jesus was left alone.
Now, all right, go ahead.
His mother was a widow by the time Jesus was 15. And under Jewish law, the next of kin came in to protect the family. We know that by the time of the crucifixion, Joseph is nowhere to be found. He's gone. He's not in the text anywhere. He's obviously dead. Joseph of Arimathea, on the other hand, was the uncle of Mary, the great uncle of Jesus, and this Joseph of Arimathea is mentioned in the Bible as wealthy. If you go to Roman sources, Joseph of Arimathea is not only wealthy, he is, in fact, nobilis decurio for the entire Roman Empire. Nobilis decurio meaning noble provider or the chief merchant of the entire empire.
Probably a land baron at the time, too.
Oh, it had palaces all over the world. He was born in Egypt. He was born in Mararica, Egypt. His family had holdings in Great Britain and Western Europe. He certainly had palaces in Arimathea.
And his relationship was on Joseph's side?
His relationship was Mary's uncle.
Mary's uncle, okay.
Mary's uncle.
All right.
And by the way, he was also a cousin of Joseph. This was a family, distantly, but not too distantly. But it was Mary's uncle. She took over the protectorship. So when Joseph of Arimathea took over the protectorship of Jesus himself, Joseph was rich. He had merchant vessels sailing all over the world. He certainly had merchant vessels sailing all the way into China, certainly into India. He, is, in fact, survives in the largest apocryphal book, which, by the way, is on the Coast to Coast AM site, which is called the Apocryphal Acts of Thomas. Joseph of Arimathea is the great merchant of Alban mentioned in the Apocryphal Acts of Thomas. The picture on the front of the cover I put there specifically because it shows Joseph of Arimathea standing in the mountains of Alban.
And how old do you think Joseph was at that time?
He was the younger brother of Sarah, Mary's mother. So he was older.
40-ish?
No, 50-ish.
Okay.
He lived a very long time. Because in 36 A.D., he was set adrift in the Mediterranean by the Sadducees, who were formerly his friends and co-workers on the Sanhedrin Council. He was set adrift in the Mediterranean with Mary Magdalene, the Virgin Mary, Longinus, Cassius Longinus, the Bethany sisters, two of Jesus' children.
Wait a minute. What do you mean, two of his children?
He had children.
He had children?
He had children. That's one thing you could not do, is acknowledge that Jesus had children.
How do you know this?
Well, there are records, varied records, which talk about these children. For example, in the Apocryphal Acts of Thomas, who did Thomas take with him into India? He took the little flute girl, or Mary Magdalene, and he took the cupbearer, or the great Tamara, or her name in India was changed to Sarah Kali, and she returns to France with Mary Magdalene after the martyrdom of Thomas, and she becomes the Black Madonna. Now, she's not black. The reason they call her the Black Madonna is because all the statues of this great, great woman were black with age because they'd been carved out of wood. And when you used a little furniture polish on them, they turned wood color again.
That's right.
But the Black Madonna is the patron saint, one of the patron saints of France, and she certainly is the exclusive patron saint of the Basque people to this very day. And her name was Tamara, or Sarah Kali, and she was the daughter of Mary Magdalene and Jesus, and was very likely with Mary Magdalene, the Virgin Mary, and Salome, who was the midwife at the birth of Christ, at the time when they went to prepare the body of Jesus for permanent interment, and they found that the stone had been rolled away, and Jesus had left the tomb.
Stay with us. Stay with us. Don't go away. We're going to get into more of these texts. Whoa. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Glenn Kimball, my guest. Glenn, let's talk a little bit about the methodology before we go back into some of the ancient texts. How much in-depth work did you have to do over these years to dig all this stuff up?
Well, obviously, collecting manuscripts from a public library system was very easy for me. I like to tell people that I climbed Mount Everest and it was a very difficult task, and that I did a hero's, I slayed three dragons and crossed a big river in order to find these texts, and they were very hidden. To be very candid with you, most of them are in the public library system to this very day. Every manuscript that I've talked about on this show so far is in the public library system. However, I did befriend two Catholic priests when I was living in Bolivia, in La Paz, Bolivia, early in my life in 1969. And they were fast friends. We'd play cards and we were just chums. I mean, we were very, very close. They were they were Irish, to be honest with you, but they were text experts who had been in the Vatican, had been allowed to be in the Vatican libraries, and they had been exiled from the Vatican for some of the things that they had said about the manuscripts that they had found. And they began to tell me about manuscripts that existed in the Vatican. And I was totally first of all, I wasn't interested, but then they were, after a few visits, it was totally fascinating to me. They began to talk to me about the extensive nature of the documents that still existed, survived in our day, and Father Eddie became a mentor of mine in terms of providing me with documents and telling me stories that I'd never ever heard before and giving me copies of ancient texts, which I later found were coincidentally buried in our library system.
Now, when you look at some of these ancient texts, are you looking at the copies of them, or are you looking at... Okay, you're not looking at the originals. You can't get
to the originals don't exist. You have to understand library systems as they existed before Gutenberg's press. The great Catholic monks or the Irish monks or whomever was keeping these libraries in existence had a perpetual task of copying over texts that were decaying over time. So they'd copy them over. Every generation, they would copy them all over again. And so the original texts have long since gone. You know, we look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are 1,500 titles in the Dead Sea Scrolls, out of which we know 800. We can actually identify 800 of them. 700 of them are in debris-like fashion. They look like confetti. They just didn't hold up. And certainly paper didn't hold up. Papyrus didn't hold up in those days. In fact, the Vatican itself has, over the last two decades, suffered and has discovered in their sealed library system a blue fungus which has eaten many, many precious papyral manuscripts that they've had hidden. They've been doing major scientific restoration and preservation in their own library systems.
Just to save them.
And you know, the Vatican's not the only place that has great library. The Vatican actually took a great deal of their library when Mussolini was in control of Italy and moved a lot of their library because they feared that Mussolini would come in eventually and either steal or destroy or plunder their library, moved it to Canada, into Montreal. And I befriended the curator of that particular library. And they have six underground floors of Vatican libraries there in Canada.
Do you find that all the texts attest to these incredible powers that Jesus had?
There's certainly a mystical element. I don't want to dwell on that too much tonight, but I certainly am certainly the reason why Jesus was profoundly integrated in all five major religions was because he was famous for these mystical occurrences. Not the least of which we're celebrating Easter now. Let me tell you something that's going to shock you.
As if nothing else has already?
Well, this one's going to even be a bigger shock, okay? We in the Western world in Christianity believe in that Jesus was crucified and resurrected.
Yes.
But the texts go much farther than that. They tell us, for example, if you open the Bible to Matthew 27:52 and 53, it talks about the multiple resurrections. Now, that's biblical, but not only were there hundreds and hundreds of dead people walking Jerusalem at the time Jesus was resurrected, but Raymond E. Brown, again from that little school called Harvard, tells us that Tiberius Caesar, the day Jesus was resurrected, had to seal the tombs of Rome to keep the dead from walking the streets.
Oh, my. Well, that's incredible all by itself.
It scared the living kajibis out of them. And in fact, he sealed those tombs with the broken cross, which eventually became the swastika.
Yes, you're right about that.
And then in Western Europe, there are legends of the dead rising, which became the celebrations of All Saints' Day, All Saints being the rising of the saints from the tomb. And what did they do to these saints? They fed them. Now, you don't feed an angel. You don't feed a ghost. You only feed tangible bodies. They fed them. And that celebration became our Halloween, which is the celebration of the rising of the dead. And that those celebrations extend all the way into China, into India, into Russia, and even into the Americas. They have a day called Dia de los Muertos, which is the Day of the Dead, where everyone goes and takes food to the graveyard. Now, why do they take food to a graveyard?
Well, either it's tradition or somebody's actually coming to eat that stuff.
Someone's coming to eat that stuff. And they're coming out of the tombs to eat it because they put the food in the graveyards. These traditions of resurrection, we talk about mystical in nature.
So you're saying these resurrections occurred?
I'm saying that they are cross-referenced from so many different directions, it's hard to ignore the phenomena.
Okay.
It's just, in fact, it's impossible to ignore. We've tried awfully hard to ignore it. Atheistic historians will tell you that's poppycock, but, you know, the point of the matter is that these legends all extend from the same period of time, talk about the same phenomena, and if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. In this case, it's resurrection. In fact, the prophecies of resurrection extended all the way back to the Messiah prophecies, which were 3,000-4,000 years old, 3,000 or 4,000 BC. As a matter of fact, the Egyptians themselves built the pyramids on the Giza Plateau as resurrection machines. We know that. Graham Hancock certainly talks about that, and others. But we know that because what are the legends of the pyramids? They are the legends of Isis, Osiris, and Horus. And what are those legends? They are the legends of virgin birth and resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where did they get that virgin birth and resurrection stuff? And they have those little holes that come out through the pyramids aimed straight for the belt of Orion.
A lot of similarities there.
Yeah, they did not manufacture these legends themselves. Egypt was a great borrowing society. They borrowed their mystical phenomena. The great astrologers and magicians in the courtyards of the pharaohs all the way back to 3,000 B.C. were all from Western Europe or Great Britain. They were druids.
Well, Glenn, how do we know that these witnesses of texts weren't just great storytellers?
Well, you know, George, that's an absolutely brilliant question. And I tend to believe that they are just storytellers until you have the same story appear in multiple locations at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Then something screwy is going on, you know. If it's like the old adage that if you put a line of 50 people and you tell the first person a secret and they whisper it all the way back, the end person tells you a different story. Well, I think that the phenomena is very different than that. What you do is you have 50 lines with 50 people in it, you tell them the same story, and the last 50 people in those 50 rows, if you cross-reference the story they tell, you can reconstruct the original story.
Yeah, they're all similar. And in many cases, those 50 people are in different regions all over the place.
And they speak different languages, and they are certainly separated by culture as well as political differences and languages. And there is no coincidences in the world.
I agree with that.
You don't come up with a strange tale of resurrection in America and have one pop up in Jerusalem in the same century. It just doesn't happen that way. It's not likely. It's like trying to say that the pyramids in the Americas were different from the pyramids in Egypt and built by separate cultures, and it was just a coincidence they were shaped the same way. That's complete poppycock.
Well, are you saying that something mystical happened during this period in human civilization? And if so, How come it's not around anymore? How come these tremendous miracles aren't occurring on a regular basis?
I think they are.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Such as?
Well,
I mean, we don't have resurrections popping up all over the place.
I'm not so sure.
Well, all right, you're going to open up a little can of worms here, but go ahead.
You know, you're getting into something I really don't want to get into.
Well, you may have to for a little bit. You're going to have to explain this to me.
Well, I have met people. You know, I'll give you an example, may I, from my own personal life?
Okay.
We'll move on. When I was writing my first book, you know, here I am basically a journalist and a communicologist, okay? Had my own radio show, done a lot of television, a lot of production work. I said, you know all about that, George,
sure,
as well as I do. Never envisioned myself a historian, though that was my private collection system. And here I wrote this. I had a near-death experience about 13 years ago where I had a chance to meet a person who doesn't need a name tag, and I'm not going to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was told to write this book. But anyway, I wrote the book, and just as I was finishing the text of my first book, which was The Hidden Stories of the Childhood of Jesus, which were the writings of Thomas and James and Matthew, the brothers of Jesus and a close friend that have been buried deliberately, when I had finished the text, I was at work one night, and it suddenly dawned on me how foolish this behavior was of mine. I says, who in the world's going to read another book about Jesus in the world? Who's ever going to do this when I've never been a historian in terms of my writings or my publications? Who's going to ever read this, you know? And to be honest with you, tears started rolling out of my eyes, and I became terribly, terribly despondent. I took the text in one hand and was about to throw it into a trash can. When in through the door walked a gentleman.
All right.
This gentleman had blue eyes, and I'm colorblind, man. I've never seen that blue, and I have not seen it since. Okay? He had blue eyes, and he walked up, and I shook his hand. I touched his hand. I felt his hand. I said, can I help you? And he said, no, but I can help you. And I said, I don't need insurance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Excuse me, you say?
And I said it just like that. I said, I don't need insurance. That's exactly what
I said. That's the first thing we'd all say.
And he said, no, you don't understand. He said, and I quote, we all know that you have written a text about Jesus and that you're about to throw it in the garbage. He said, don't, because tens of thousands of people will read that manuscript and it will raise their faith. And I went, what? I backed up. I hit the wall. I hit the counter with my keister.
And where's the text at this time? In your hand still?
Yeah, it's still in my hand.
Okay.
I dropped it all over the ground. I bent over to pick it up, stood up, and this man was gone.
Poof.
He could not have exited the building. It was not possible.
What did he look like beyond the blue eyes?
Handsome man. Handsome man. A man with penetrating stare that sent it still to, I'll be honest with you, George, it was so impactful. I sobbed for 2 days because I figured I'd screwed up.
I mean, did you go running outside the room to look for him?
Sure I did. I ran around the building twice. It didn't help. I couldn't find him.
Oh, incredible.
Now, you're asking me a question. That was very personal, George, but you asked, and so I answered that.
And I think it was important for you to bring that up because it sets a stage for, I think, and I don't want to say the word obsession with your investigations, but the driving force behind it.
I have no choice, George. This is not a theme that can make you money and live on it. This is just something that I must do. I must do it. Though I'm nobody special, I'm certainly not clergy. I will never be remembered in history as being some individual of note, except somebody has to speak in defense of the ancient text. Somebody has to quit burying the text and speak favorably of the text that already exists in open forums.
Why bury the text? Because is there anything there that they should be afraid of?
I think there are texts that offend everybody. For example, let me give you a specific example. In Catholicism, our great people, the Catholics, have preserved for us so many documents, and I don't want to offend them in any way. I want to encourage them. But they are very vehement about being against Gnostic texts. And we have one of the texts that survives that's a Gnostic text in our day is called the Gospel of Thomas, which was written by Thomas. It contains what is called a broad collection of agrapha, agrapha meaning the actual words of Jesus. It is the most extensive collection of agrapha in history, probably, outside the Nag Hammadi. Well, it's actually inside the Nag Hammadi because the Gospel of Thomas is contained in the Nag Hammadi. But in the 12th verse of the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus is asked point blank, who will succeed you when you are dead? And Jesus is sitting in front of his apostles, and he said, my brother James, for which reason the heavens and earth came into being. And that is a quote, by the way. However, Catholicism gets its right for the authority of the authority or the perpetuity of Christianity from Peter. Peter was not the head of the church following the death of Christ. James was. As a matter of fact, Peter said, if anyone disagrees with James, including me, they are wrong. Peter said that in his homily.
So even Peter admitted James was running the show.
Well, every historian that is a Judeo-Christian historian of any merit will tell you that James certainly was the head of the church in Jerusalem. And if you were the head of the church in Jerusalem, you were the head of the church.
Now, this is the same James where we just found the ossuary of him?
Exactly. Okay.
Okay.
This is Jesus' older brother. We know who the brothers and sisters of Jesus were because we go to Matthew 13, 55, and 56. It tells you the names of the brothers and sisters of Jesus. James is one of them. And certainly, Jesus had four older stepbrothers, two older stepbrothers and two older stepsisters.
But you don't think they talk in terms of, hi, Glenn, you're my brother, and there she is, my sister.
Absolutely not. That's a modern apology of that passage. And not a literal translation.
All right.
If you go back, the Vatican, the great Vatican bishops in America and the great Episcopal leaders in America came out in a program called The Portrait of the Virgin Mary. By the way, I had to really urge them hard on this one. I put them backed them into the wall. They openly confessed that there are verifiable records that Joseph had been married prior to marrying the Virgin Mary and then left a widower with four children. Two sons, the youngest of which was James.
That wouldn't shock me.
Shouldn't be shocking.
No.
Because that was
that's part of life.
Very open.
Yeah, I mean that's part of humanity. If
you can find it in your public library, whether you know it or not, this is a story that's not real well hidden. They'd like to hide it, but it's not well hidden. And then Jesus, the Virgin Mary had had Jesus and two younger sons. Thomas and Joses, who was also called Barnabas. Joses after, you know, obviously Joseph, his father. And Thomas, or Judas Didymus Thomas, as it refers to in Matthew 13, 55 and 56. And Thomas is often called the twin of Christ, though he wasn't a twin of Christ, because he looks so much like him.
I assume they were all naturally conceived?
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly Thomas and Joses were. Jesus is the suspect one here, and I don't even want to mention that. It's not. I'm not going to mention what I think about that, except that's a question for the clergy and not for a historian.
Understand. Okay. Stay with us, Glenn. We'll be back in a moment. We'll continue this dialogue about these ancient texts, as we're only a couple weeks away from Easter, aren't we? I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with my guest, Glenn Kimble. Glenn, in your opinion, what do you think is more important, the Nag Hammadi Library or the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example?
They're two different things. The Dead Sea Scrolls is largely Old Testament in origin. The Nag Hammadi texts are largely New Testament. So you're asking me which is more important, New Testament or Old Testament? You're talking apples and oranges. So I really don't think you could say you could really...
They're both important.
They're both important. And there are hundreds and thousands of other libraries and document collections which are equally important. You know, there was a great find in Ebla, the Ebla tablets. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those. That was in northeastern Syria, very close to Iraq. These tablets were an extensive economic and historical and political collection of documents that were from the 2500 BC era, well, actually 2700 years BC era, which survive in our day, which are every bit as important as the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi texts. And they're older, obviously older, written in cuneiform at the time of the same century as the pyramids were built. So, which is the most important collection? That's like saying who's more important, your mother or your father.
Yeah, and you can't pick.
You can't.
You know, what it does tell me, though, that there was a period on this planet that in one hand, Glenn, was so exciting to be around, and at the same time, there were so many things in terms of spirituality and just a grasp or an understanding for what life might have been like during those periods of thousands of years ago, through the beginning of human origin. And to me, that's one of the bigger stories of all time.
Well, it certainly is. You know, at the time of Christ, much of the impetus locally around Jesus and locally in Jerusalem. First of all, Jerusalem and northern Galilee, they had been at war with each other for 300 years over one of the daughters of Benjamin had been molested by one of the northern tribal groups. The 10 tribes were settled in the northern part of Palestine, and Benjamin had centered part of Joseph and two tribes settled in the southern part, and they had been at war with each other for over 300 years by the time of Christ. And so when someone says that he was coming from Nazareth or from Caesarea, I'm not sure there was even a Nazareth at the time of Jesus, you're talking about someone coming from the wrong side of the tracks, because the real seed of religious movement was in Jerusalem, not in the merchant traffic towns in the northern part of Galilee. So, you know, Jesus was not well respected in his by those in Jerusalem, and was often condemned, when in fact in Galilee he was followed by thousands. You know, we have the story about him feeding the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of the reason why thousands followed him is because that wasn't the only time he fed the thousands. He was wealthy enough to have fed thousands. Just happened on that occasion, he didn't have the food to feed the thousands, and a mystical experience occurred. But his family had been very philanthropic. They had given a third of their income to the poor and needy, and that was contained in one of the Gospels written by James and one by Matthew, where it talks about the philanthropy of the family of Christ. So it wasn't uncommon for people who were hungry to follow Jesus, to be fed. You know.
Well, of course. I mean, we just see what's happening, for example, in Iraq. They're following our troops now because we're loaded with food for them.
Exactly. Exactly.
Are you convinced, though, that during the period of Jesus, that it was laden with some tremendously mystical experiences that surrounded him?
Yes. In fact, there were probably 10 pretenders to the Messiah throne in the generation of Jesus. Apollonius was one of them, who performed feats of magic, healed the sick. The only thing Apollonius didn't do to fulfill the Messiah prophecies was die on the cross and be resurrected, excluded him from the Messiah candidacy.
Yep, right away. Let's go to some phones. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast with my guest, Glenn Kimble. Hi there.
Hey, this is Robert from San Diego, California, Kogo 600 AM.
Well, welcome, and good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning. And, Glenn, I want to say thank you very much for being on. I myself am under the, I'm studying ancient Hebrew so I can read the Old Testament for myself because I'm very fascinated by Hebrew mythology. I think it's, for me, it's just fascinating. And you mentioned that a lot of all this information is in the public libraries. I was just wondering, in San Diego, they're not known for their prestigious libraries. They're small, local, community libraries all over the place. I mean, will those libraries still have the same information that you're talking about?
Well, the interlibrary loan system would have it. You can come to my website. There are many of the books that are still in print are still there, and there are research links for those who are poor students that need to just research. I've been there myself for 10 years, you know, so I know what it's like. Use the research links, and you'll find that will help you greatly to locate documents and resources. There's over 300 major research links on my site that will help you find ancient texts.
Glenn, I'm getting some emails from people who want to know if any of this is available through you in audio form or in Braille for people who might be blind.
Dan, I wish it were. I wish that were financially feasible for me to produce it in audio. I produced a tape called Joseph of Arimathea, Foster Father of Christ. That is in audio tape, and by the way, it's almost sold out. We had somewhat up to thousands of those tapes produced, and I'm down to a handful of a couple hundred.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason why I moved here to Arizona was to be in position to have a studio to be able to do audio tapes.
Sure.
And it's been a long time coming, and I've just been here for 10 days in Arizona. Love it.
Well, I can tell you by the emails I'm getting, there's a need there for it.
It certainly is.
Let's go to a first-time caller. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hi. My name is Angela. I'm calling from upstate New York.
Sure thing, Angela.
Love
go
your
ahead.
Show.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask Glenn what his take was on the early church fathers' exclusion of certain manuscripts and if it has anything to do with an anti-feminine aspect of the early church, anti-woman.
I really don't think so. I think the anti-feminists came long before with the Greeks.
Okay.
And the Romans prior to the 4th century of the Nicene Council.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, some of the earliest historical societies in the world were matriarchal societies.
Right.
That changed with the onslaught of very masculine Greek and Roman traditions and some of the Eastern traditions as well. Which are planted. Actually, some of the earliest Eastern traditions were feminine traditions.
Right.
You notice one curious thing about that. The word Elohim, which mm-hmm. is the name that was the name that could not be uttered by Moses for fear of blasphemy. Moses would never have had a problem with saying God damn, but he would have a very strong problem with using the word Elohim in vain. Elohim was the sacred name, but Elohim, Eloi, is feminine, and Him is plural. So the father, or the society from which we have come to this earth under, or descendants of, or related to, is the Elohim, which is a very matriarchal name, a very matriarchal society. No, I don't think the Nicene Council had anything to do with supplanting women, or the bearing of the books had anything to do with getting rid of books by women. That had happened a long time ago. For example, the Dead Sea Scrolls has every book in the Bible in the Old Testament with the exception of the books written by women. And so that discrimination had happened long before the Constantine and the Nicene Council. We have to congratulate Constantine. He did a marvelous job of consolidating the warring factions of Christianity. There were more warring factions of Christianity at the time of Constantine than there are today.
Isn't it amazing, though, Glenn, how religion, though, continues to be one of the focal points for war on this planet?
Well,
it has not gone away.
I can tell you the reason why. Religion is a way people identify themselves to themselves. It's a part of their self-identity. When in reality, the real reasons for war are most often not religion. They're largely economical. And to be honest with you, the war we're having with Iraq today has little original basis in religion, religious difference, and a great deal to do with economic differences. For example, in the East, if you build a house in Saudi Arabia, for example, there's no county recorder where you can record your deed. So if you leave town for 2 weeks, someone can occupy your house, and unless you have the power to kick them out, they can occupy a house forever. In the West, you record the county deed, and you can leave for 50 years and come back, and that house is still yours.
As long as you pay the taxes in those 50 years.
But what that does is that in the East, they don't have any way of, they don't have the same system of ownership that we do in the West, and therefore the people in the Middle East cannot participate in credit cards and in the world economy the same way as Western people can. So it's an issue, to my, in my estimation. In fact, the head of the economic institutes of the world have all said this, that the problem between the Middle East and Western nations is one of difference in concept of ownership more than religious in nature.
And, you know, and I'm sure you get emails pro and con from people who accept what you say, people who don't. And sometimes, do you find that they are vicious?
I get my life threatened once a week.
Once a week?
I did this morning.
Merely because...
my life this morning on the email.
Merely because these are your views, this is what you think, this is what you have interpreted because of the work you've done, you have your life threatened.
It's common. I'm sad to say, but it's common. And you know, I'm not as terrified as I once was. Not because I think the threat is not real, or if they do me in, I've already been to the other side and seen what's there. You do me a great favor.
Yes.
I go back to where I was most happy. And if you don't, too bad. You want to make an appointment? I used to, in Salt Lake City, I used to make an appointment with these people, say, I'll meet you at Friday night at 9 o'clock on the street corner. Be there. And I used to show up.
Well, you're lucky they didn't.
They didn't. None of them ever did.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I have a statement, two questions, which I'll make very brief.
Mm-hmm.
The statement is, are you aware that the Serapian documents you referred to was based on the false god Serapis, created from Apis the winged bull and Osiris, which was on record at the library at Ulm long before Alexander the Great came, or Alexander the Macedonian came in there and sacked that temple. These people could not even read and write when they first came into Egypt. That's a statement. The two questions. Are you aware of the two black men, one, Apollonius of Tyana, which was usurped by Eusebius and Constantine at the Council of Nicene, and a modern decade, Simeon Toko of Angola? If you want me to stay on, I can. If not, then I'll have to hang up.
Well, I'll let you listen on the radio.
Well,
what would be the significance, of before you leave me here, of the question, first of all?
Well, the question is that when he made the statement that the document that he had, the Serapian document, was based on, again, what was found there by Alexander the Great. Well, he was not Alexander the Great. That is a title given to him that he did not earn. He was Alexander from Macedonia, who sacked Persepolis with an army when he stated again that he had seen one of his chief ambassadors or something disemboweled. He couldn't read. He couldn't write. I mean, this is not one of these Shakespearean actors that plays the part. Secondly, when they came in there, if they couldn't read and write, how could they create a library within a decade? The point was that the library there was called Ulm. Ulm had the records again of Apollonius, which is what I brought up in asking him, which was then counseled again at the Council of Nicene by Constantine the Great and by Eusebius, his bishop, which started the whole mess of the modern Christian era.
All right, well, let's get Glenn's take on it. Glenn, obviously, he was in your university taking courses with you side by side.
And he asked about 40 questions in a statement.
Well, we won't have time for 40 answers,
yeah,
so take the one you want.
Well, obviously, when he's talking about his Serapian documents, he's talking about at the time of Alexander the Great, which was 300 years before Jesus. The Serapian document I'm talking about was from the same cultural entity, but written during the lifetime of Jesus. So the Serapian documents can be considered a collection and also an individual manuscript. So, you know, it depends upon what you're talking about here. And in terms of libraries, you know, how many of those questions should I answer, you know?
Well, based on the fact that I've got every line lit with questions, not too many.
Yeah, well, he's right. And this good gentleman has done a lot of homework.
Oh, it sounds like he knows what he's talking about.
And we could take it one issue at a time. But certainly Alexander the Great was a disciple of Aristotle. He learned under Aristotle, and because of that relationship with Aristotle, he had a pedagogical background and training which fostered the environment which eventually led to the creation of the Alexandria Library, regardless of the literacy of Alexander the Great personally.
All right, let's go next to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George. This is Athena calling from Seattle.
Hi, Athena. What a great name.
Thank you. I have a question for I love your show, and what a fascinating topic tonight. I have a question for your guest.
Sure. He's there listening and ready to go.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
Hi. Are you aware of the I just wonder if you're aware of the hidden archives in St. Catherine's Monastery at the base of Mount Sinai?
Yes.
Have
the St. Catherine documents, the collection, it's one of the great collections of all times.
I understood that I was there, and I was told at the time that they were hidden, they were kept private, not that they did not allow access to the public.
That's true, but they are published. Some of them are. The St. Catherine's documents, that you can access them, some of them. But it's like trying to access all the Dead Sea Scrolls. We can only really access in English 60 to 80 of those scrolls when there were 1,800 titles entirely in the collection. So St. Catherine's documents is the same way. There are several that we can access, but the entire collection is under lock and key and protected from the public, as were documents throughout history. That's what Apocrypha means, is something too secret and sacred to be in the hands of the common people. That's why Constantine, he used that as an excuse to bury the books, but really what Constantine did was a great favor, was he squelched the warring factors by compromising and saying, we will exclude all the documents except the ones we can agree on. And that edited out the majority of them.
I had my most profound mystical experience of my entire life in that monastery.
I wouldn't doubt it. Try and use the restroom. That's a mystical experience in itself.
Is there any way that I could have access to what is available of St. Catherine's documents?
Try the research links on my site. You may find something there.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
All right, good luck there. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Glenn, we're coming up to the break, so let me ask you just a quick question, and then we'll come back with more phone calls. The people of these eras must have been pretty darn intelligent, and I think modern society probably doesn't give them the credit that they were due.
Oh, without doubt. And I think in Western Europe that's even more obvious. When we think of Western Europe, we think about barbarian tribes and guys wearing fur and dressing up with horns on their head, you know. We don't think of them as being scholars. The Scythian monks being Germanic monks, which preserved libraries, and the Caesars of Rome had libraries there, and there were Romans who never saw Rome who lived in Western Europe who were well educated.
I tell you what, I wouldn't mind getting into a time machine and going back to those eras and just taking a look at that stuff. Stay with us, Glenn Kimball, my guest. Your calls right around the corner on Coast to Coast AM. Coast to Coast, I'm George Norrie with my guest, Glenn Kimball. Glenn, in your opinion, what do you think is more important, the Nag Hammadi Library or the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example?
They're two different things. The Dead Sea Scrolls is largely Old Testament
mm-hmm.
in origin. The Nag Hammadi texts are largely New Testament. So you're asking me which is more important, New Testament or Old Testament? You're talking apples and oranges. So I really don't think you could say you could really.
They're both important.
They're both important. And there are hundreds and thousands of other libraries and document collections which are equally important. You know, there was a great find in Ebla, the Ebla tablets. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those. That was in northeastern Syria, very close to Iraq. These tablets were an extensive economic and historical and political collection of documents that were from the 2500 BC era, well, actually 2700 years BC era, which survive in our day, which are every bit as important as the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nachamite texts. And they're older, obviously older, written in cuneiform at the time of the same century as the pyramids were built. So, you know, which is the most important collection? That's like saying who's more important, your mother or your father.
Yeah, and you can't pick.
You can't.
You know, what it does tell me, though, that there was a period on this planet that in one hand, Glenn, was so exciting to be around, and at the same time, there were so many things in terms of spirituality and just a grasp or an understanding for what life might have been like during those periods of thousands of years ago through the beginning of human origin. And to me, that's one of the bigger stories of all time.
Well, it certainly is. You know, at the time of Christ, much of the impetus locally around Jesus and locally in Jerusalem. First of all, Jerusalem and northern Galilee, they had been at war with each other for 300 years over one of the daughters of Benjamin had been molested by one of the northern tribal groups. The 10 tribes were settled in the northern part of Palestine, and Benjamin had centered and part of Joseph and two tribes settled in the southern part, and they had been at war with each other for over 300 years by the time of Christ. And so when someone says that he was coming from Nazareth or from Caesarea, I'm not sure there was even a Nazareth at the time of Jesus, you're talking about someone coming from the wrong side of the tracks, because the real seed of religious movement was in Jerusalem, not in the merchant traffic towns in the northern part of Galilee. So, you know, Jesus was not well respected in his by those in Jerusalem, and was often condemned, when in fact in Galilee he was followed by thousands. You know, we have the story about him feeding the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of the reason why thousands followed him is because that wasn't the only time he fed the thousands. He was wealthy enough to have fed thousands. Just happened on that occasion he didn't have the food to feed the thousands, and a mystical experience occurred. But his family had been very philanthropic. They had given a third of their income to the poor and needy, and that was contained in one of the Gospels written by James and one by Matthew, where it talks about the philanthropy of the family of Christ. So it wasn't uncommon for people who were hungry to follow Jesus, to be fed. You know?
Well, of course. I mean, we just see what's happening, for example, in Iraq. They're following our troops now because we're loaded with food for them.
Exactly. Exactly.
Are you convinced, though, that during the period of Jesus, that it was laden with some tremendously mystical experiences that surrounded him?
Yes. In fact, there were probably 10 pretenders to the Messiah throne in the generation of Jesus. Apollonius was one of them, who performed feats of magic, healed the sick. The only thing Apollonius didn't do to fulfill the Messiah prophecies was die on the cross and be resurrected,
which immediately
excluded him from the Messiah candidacy.
Yep, right away. Let's go to some phones. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast with my guest, Glenn Kimball. Hi there.
Hey, this is Robert from San Diego, California, Kogo 600 AM.
Well, welcome, and good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning. And, Glenn, I want to say thank you very much for being on. I myself am I'm studying ancient Hebrew so I can read the Old Testament for myself, because I'm very fascinated by Hebrew mythology. I think it's for me, it's just fascinating. And you mentioned that a lot of all of this information is in the public libraries. I'm just wondering, in San Diego, they're not known for their prestigious libraries. They're small, local, community libraries all over the place. I mean, will those libraries still have the same information that you're talking about?
Well, the interlibrary loan system would have it. You can come to my website. There are many of the books that are still in print are still there, and there are research links for those who are poor students that need to just research. I've been there myself for 10 years, you know, so I know what it's like. Use the research links, and you'll find that will help you greatly to locate documents and resources. There's over 300 major research links on my site that will help you find ancient texts.
Glenn, I'm getting some emails from people who want to know if any of this is available through you in audio form or in Braille for people who might be blind.
Man, I wish it were. I wish that were financially feasible for me to produce it in audio. I produced a tape called Joseph of Arimathea, Foster Father of Christ. That is an audio tape, and by the way, it's almost sold out. We had somewhat up to thousands of those tapes produced, and I'm down to a handful of a couple hundred.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason why I moved here to Arizona was to be in position to have a studio to be able to do audio tapes.
Sure.
And it's been a long time coming, and I've just been here for 10 days in Arizona. Love it.
Well, I can tell you by the emails I'm getting, there's a need there for it.
It certainly is.
Let's go to a first-time caller. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hi. My name is Angela. I'm calling from upstate New York.
Sure thing, Angela.
Love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask Glenn what his take was on the early church fathers' exclusion of certain manuscripts and if it has anything to do with an anti-feminine aspect of the early church, anti-woman.
I really don't think so. I think the anti-feminists came long before with the Greeks.
Okay.
And the Romans prior to the 4th century of the Nicene Council.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, some of the earliest historical societies in the world were matriarchal societies.
Right.
That changed with the onslaught of very masculine Greek and Roman traditions and some of the Eastern traditions as well, which are planted. Actually, some of the earliest Eastern traditions were feminine traditions.
Right.
You notice one curious thing about that. The word Elohim, which mm-hmm. is the name that was the name that could not be uttered by Moses for fear of blasphemy. Moses would never have had a problem with saying God damn, but he would have a very strong problem with using the word Elohim in vain. Elohim was the sacred name, but Elohim, Eloi, is feminine, and Him is plural. So the father or the society from which we have come to this earth under or descendants of or related to is the Elohim, which is a very matriarchal name, a very matriarchal society. No, I don't think the Nicene Council had anything to do with supplanting women or the bearing of the books had anything to do with getting rid of books by women. That had happened a long time ago. For example, the Dead Sea Scrolls has every book in the Bible in the Old Testament with the exception of the books written by women. And so that discrimination had happened long before the Constantine and the Nicene Council. We have to congratulate Constantine. He did a marvelous job of consolidating the warring factions of Christianity. There were more warring factions of Christianity at the time of Constantine than there are today.
Isn't it amazing, though, Glenn, how religion, though, continues to be one of the focal points for war on this planet?
Well,
it has not gone away.
I can tell you the reason why. Religion is a way people identify themselves to themselves. It's a part of their self-identity. When in reality, the real reasons for war are most often not religion. They're largely economical. And to be honest with you, the war we're having with Iraq today has little original basis in religion, religious difference, and a great deal to do with economic differences. For example, in the East, if you build a house in Saudi Arabia, for example, there's no county recorder where you can record your deed. So if you leave town for 2 weeks, someone can occupy your house, and unless you have the power to kick them out, they can occupy a house forever. In the West, you record the county deed, and you can leave for 50 years and come back, and that house is still yours.
As long as you pay the taxes in those 50 years.
As long as you pay the taxes. But what that does is that in the East, they don't have any way of – they don't have the same system of ownership that we do in the West, and therefore – the people in the Middle East cannot participate in credit cards and in the world economy the same way as Western people can. So it's an issue, in my estimation. In fact, the head of the economic institutes of the world have all said this, that the problem between the Middle East and Western nations is one of difference in concept of ownership more than religious in nature.
And, you know, and I'm sure you get emails pro and con from people who accept what you say, people who don't. And sometimes, do you find that they are vicious?
I get my life threatened once a week.
Once a week?
I did this morning.
Merely because...
my life this morning on the email.
Merely because these are your views, this is what you think, this is what you have interpreted because of the work you've done. You have your life threatened.
It's common. I'm sad to say, but it's common. And you know, I'm not as terrified as I once was. Not because I think the threat is not real, or if they do me in, I've already been to the other side and seen what's there. You do me a great favor.
Yes.
I go back to where I was most happy. And if you don't, too bad. You want to make an appointment? I used to, in Salt Lake City, I used to make an appointment with these people, say, I'll meet you at Friday night at 9 o'clock on the street corner. Be there. And I used to show up.
Well, you're lucky they didn't.
They didn't. None of them ever did.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I have a statement, two questions, which I'll make very brief.
Mm-hmm.
The statement is, are you aware that the Serapian documents you referred to was based on the false god Serapis, created from Apis the winged bull and Osiris, which was on record at the library at Ulm long before Alexander the Great came, or Alexander the Macedonian came in there and sacked that temple. These people could not even read and write when they first came into Egypt. That's a statement. The two questions, are you aware of the two black men, one, Apollonius of Tyana, which was usurped by Eusebius and Constantine at the Council of Nicene, and a modern decade, Simeon Toko of Angola. If you want me to stay on, I can. If not, then I'll have to hang up.
Well, I'll let you listen on the radio.
Well,
what would be the significance, before you leave me here, of the question, first of all?
Well, the question is that when he made the statement that the document that he had, the Serapian document, was based on, again, what was found there by Alexandria. Alexander the Great. Well, he was not Alexander the Great. That is a title given to him that he did not earn. He was Alexander from Macedonia, who sacked Persepolis with an army when he stated again that he had seen one of his chief ambassadors or something disemboweled. He couldn't read. He couldn't write. I mean, this is not one of these Shakespearean actors that plays the part. Secondly, when they came in there, if they couldn't read and write, how could they create a library within a decade? The point was that the library there was called Ulm. Ulm had the records again of Apollonius, which is what I brought up in asking him, which was then counseled again at the Council of Nicene by Constantine the Great and by Eusebius, his bishop, which started the whole mess of the modern Christian era.
All right, well, let's get Glenn's take on it. Glenn, obviously he was in your university taking courses with you side by side.
And he asked about 40 questions in a statement.
Well, we won't have time for 40 answers,
yeah,
so take the one you want.
Well, obviously, when he's talking about his Serapian documents, he's talking about at the time of Alexander the Great, which was 300 years before Jesus. The Serapian document I'm talking about was from the same cultural entity, but written during the lifetime of Jesus. So the Serapian documents can be considered a collection and also an individual manuscript. So, you know, it depends upon what you're talking about here. And in terms of libraries, you know, how many of those questions should I answer? You know,
well, based on the fact that I've got every line lit with questions, not too many.
Yeah, well, he's right. And this good gentleman has done a lot of homework.
Oh, it sounds like he knows what he's talking about.
And we could take it one issue at a time. But certainly Alexander the Great was a disciple of Aristotle. He learned under Aristotle. And because of that relationship with Aristotle, He had a pedagogical background and training which fostered the environment which eventually led to the creation of the Alexandria Library, regardless of the literacy of Alexander the Great personally.
All right, let's go next to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George. This is Athena calling from Seattle.
Hi, Athena. What a great name.
Thank you. I have a question for I love your show, and what a fascinating topic tonight. I have a question for your guest.
Sure. He's there listening and ready to go.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
Hi. Are you aware of the, I just wonder if you're aware of the hidden archives in St. Catherine's Monastery at the base of Mount Sinai?
Yes.
Have
the St. Catherine documents, the collection? It's one of the great collections of all times.
I understood that I was there, and I was told at the time that they were hidden, they were kept private, not that they did not allow access to the public.
That's true, but they are published. Some of them are. The St. Catherine's documents, that you can access them, some of them. But it's like trying to access all the Dead Sea Scrolls. We can only really access in English 60 to 80 of those scrolls when there were 1,800 titles entirely in the collection. So St. Catherine's documents is the same way. There are several that we can access, but the entire collection is under lock and key and protected from the public, as were documents throughout history. That's what Apocrypha means, is something too secret and sacred to be in the hands of the common people. That's why Constantine, he used that as an excuse to bury the books, but really what Constantine did was a great favor, was he squelched the warring factors by compromising and saying we will exclude all the documents except the ones we can agree on. And that edited out the majority of them.
I had my most profound mystical experience of my entire life in that monastery.
I wouldn't doubt it. Try and use the restroom. That's a mystical experience in itself.
Is there any way that I could have access to what is available of St. Catherine's documents?
Try the research links on my site. You may find something there.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
All right, good luck there. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Glenn, we're coming up to the break, so let me ask you just a quick question, and then we'll come back with more phone calls. The people of these eras must have been pretty darn intelligent, and I think modern society probably doesn't give them the credit that they were due.
Oh, without doubt. And I think in Western Europe that's even more obvious. When we think of Western Europe, we think about barbarian tribes and guys wearing fur and dressing up with horns on their head, you know. We don't think of them as being scholars. The Scythian monks being Germanic monks, which preserved libraries, and the Caesars of Rome had libraries there. And there were Romans who never saw Rome, who lived in Western Europe, who were well-educated.
I tell you what, I wouldn't mind getting into a time machine and going back to those eras and just taking a look at that stuff. Stay with us, Glenn Kimball, my guest. Your calls right around the corner on Coast to Coast AM. Coast to Coast, Glenn Kimball, my guest. Glenn, I wasn't kidding right before the break when I said I would love to get in a time machine and go back to that time period and witness some of those things. Would you come along for the ride?
I most certainly would. You know, I created a pilot for the Discovery Channel a year ago whereby my producers did a computer-generated recreation of the Temple of Solomon. And the thing that was unique about it was that I was able to interject my own physical self into this temple, walk around and show people the various artifacts and things on the wall, etc. It was totally unique. They've been able to do computer generate recreations of buildings, but you've never had the host actually walk into those buildings or meet people as they came out of the building and talk to them like ancient characters in history.
Oh, that must have been exciting.
Oh, it's fun. And, you know, one day we will 911 came along and ruined the advertising rates, and you know that better than
I do. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was a difficult time for all of us.
We already had the show in the highest levels of negotiation, and it was ruined overnight with one day. Wrecked our plan.
Horrible terrorists affected more than just what they did, I'll tell you.
My life was totally impacted by what happened, obviously so.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I wanted to tell your people before the time does run out that on the website, these three documents, let me explain them just briefly that are there. One is the writings and teachings of the Buddha Isa, who was Jesus, and that was preserved and excavated and translated in 1897, brought back to us by a journalist from Russia. The Tibetan New Testament, which was the original gospel of the 12 apostles, is preserved in Buddhism or in the Tibetan libraries.
That's a great manuscript, by the way.
Oh, it is, because and you know how it probably got into Tibet was there was a Blavatsky excavated a Buddhist monastery on the banks of the Dead Sea at the time of Jesus. It was very likely that James, who was very Essene in orientation. The Essenes were very much like the Buddhists in the sense that they were vegetarians and they were celibate and they were monkish-like. And the one thing that they shared in common was both of them had a love for Christ. James had a love for his brother. The Tibetans loved him because Jesus was their Buddha Isa. And when James realized that the Romans were going to create havoc in Jerusalem, one of the ways he could preserve documents was to take massively some documents and give them to the Buddhists to preserve them, in hopes that by preserving them in the Buddhist monasteries that they would survive, and in fact they did. And that is such a magnificent document, magnificent. It makes me dance around the room every time I read it.
Well, I'm not going to go quite that far, but I'm glad you are.
Well, I'm a heavy fellow. I may not look too heavy, but I'm a heavy fellow. When I dance around, we alter gravitational forces. You know?
Yeah, you're a pole shift when you dance around.
That's true. The compass does not point in the same direction on one side. But the last document, obviously, is the post-crucifixion missionary diaries or writings of Thomas as he was sent to India. Jesus, when he was asked to return to India by the great monarchs of the East, wrote him a letter and says, "I cannot go, but I will send another in my place." And the one he sent, obviously, through James, was his brother Thomas. And Thomas took with him Mary Magdalene and the children of Christ, the two children of Christ. And when Thomas was martyred, obviously Mary Magdalene had financial interests with her family in France, which were mining interests, and they returned to France and stayed there permanently to get out of the way of the marauding Sadducees who were wreaking havoc, and eventually they lost their power.
You have done your homework, haven't you?
Of course.
You sure have. I am very impressed with your knowledge of these ancient texts. And all that though is on the website.
Oh, yeah, yes. But the thing is that those texts are so precious. If you want to do some dancing, go to George's site, coasttocoastam.com. If you haven't already danced on his site, tonight is a good night.
Well, I wonder what you're like during Easter. For
I get my ears on. You ought to see that.
First time caller, you're on the air with Glenn Kimball. Go ahead.
Hello, good evening, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, it's Peter from Toronto, the home of the Maple Leaf.
Nice biblical name there, Peter.
Exactly. I've been listening to the show, and I'm totally blown away. This is amazing. You put out concepts to the cosmos I've never even considered. And one of those thoughts is that you said, Mr. Kimball, that Jesus had children, I do believe.
Most definitely. And as a matter of fact, the divine right of kings mentioned by the monarchies all the way from Russia through Germany into Great Britain and France and Spain, etc., that divine right of kings was divine because they could trace their ancestries back to the bloodline of Joseph of Arimathea and Jesus himself. That was the secret. That's why Napoleon had to marry Josephine, or he could not officially be king of France, because he did not have the blood of Jesus in his veins. Josephine did. This divine right of kings may be a secret to the common man, but it is not a secret amongst the monarchies. It never has been a secret. Beneath the throne of England today is still the stone of Jacob. You know, Jacob. They call it Jacob's pillar. This is the stone of the divine right of kings. They retain their kingdoms because of their bloodlines or grail lines, holy grail, meaning holy blood, to the descendancy of Jesus.
This is totally amazing. I'm retaining all this knowledge. So if I talk to my mom, I'll be telling her about all this tomorrow. One last question, then a question that I'll listen on. Do you really think, sir, that the ossuary of James that they found was really the ossuary of James?
Absolutely, I really do. James, there are many artifacts, not just his funerary box, but they found his house, they found the furniture, they found utensils of James. This is a big deal because this is a new find, and because it was probably the tomb of his bones. But you notice they didn't find the tomb. They didn't find the funerary box of Peter in Jerusalem. Peter wasn't martyred in Jerusalem. James sent Peter on mission. He sent all the rest of the apostles on missions, and he is the exclusive apostle who stayed put and led the church from Jerusalem. That is the reason why he was the surviving head of the church following the death of Christ. And there are people who get their authority or get their right to own Jesus from John. We know there was a great fraternal order of John, which became an economic society, which extended all the way across from Western Europe into China. We know that there's the tradition of Peter, which became the Catholicism and Protestant Christianity. And there are other, there's the churches of Thomas in India. And on the list go. Everyone picks out their favorite apostle, and they use that person as the reason to own Jesus.
And the last time we saw the ossuary was in, I think it was in Toronto, but it's probably gone from there now, isn't it? I don't know where it would be. They had it on display several months ago.
Yeah, I don't know where it is.
And it had a little crack to it. I guess it cracked when it was being shipped from Israel to Toronto. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome, you're on the air with Glenn Kimball. Hi there. Hello?
Yeah. I'm sorry. This is Ben from Louisville.
Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
I've come to my beliefs, I guess, I would call myself a Buddhist Christian. It's just because, like, all the readings I've done, I've just seen, you know, there's, like, astounding similarities between the two religions. And the teachings of both teachers, and I just wanted to know exactly how you would explain or what you know. There's a lot of theories on why they're so similar. I just want to know what your thoughts were on the correlation between the two.
Buddha and Christianity, and also let me ask you a question, if I can, Glenn, about that. Did you say that Jesus was Buddha?
Jesus is the greatest of the Buddhas, and they call him Buddha Issa.
Okay, who's the Buddha that we see in these statues, the very
Dharma.
Rotund person? Okay.
The Buddha Dharma, who is the original Buddha in 640 B.C.
Ah, all right.
However, if you go in and ask the Buddhists themselves who was the greatest of all the Buddhas, if you get to the Grand Lamas, they will tell you the Buddha Issa exclusively. And his writings and his teachings are on your website. And that Buddha Issa says, my name is Jesus, and I am going to return to Jerusalem and finish my mission and be crucified. He said that in the writings and records of the Buddhists.
It's just incredible. It really is. But now, what's the correlation between Christianity for him and being a Buddhist?
Well, the greatest of the Buddhists was Christian. He was Christ.
Yeah, they are. One of the same.
I mean, is there a correlation? Well, maybe not a correlation. Maybe an exclusive identity. Maybe they were the same originally. Certainly Buddhism comes out of the great Brahma tradition as well as Hinduism. But remember what Brahmanism is. The word Brahma sounds too coincidentally like the word Abraham. Abraham, Brahma. There are many scholars around the world today who believe that Brahma was in fact Abraham. And if that's the case, then the Messiah traditions were in fact the origins of Buddhism and Hinduism, and that's why there's such a great similarity between Buddhism and the Judeo-Christian traditions in our day.
But the, being Islamic, Muslims, that has no similarities at all, does it?
It certainly does.
Oh, it does?
But it's a Johnny-come-lately church. They were, obviously, Muhammad is in the 6th century A.D.
Yeah, it came 600 years later, didn't it?
600 years later, and by the way, the Quran has some of the most precious words of Jesus that are not in our Bible that can be imagined. And Jesus is obviously the greatest prophet of Islam, considered by the greatest Islamic leaders in the world, considered Jesus the greatest prophet of Islam. In fact, Muhammad never intended to start a church. His intent was to take the paganistic movements of Christianity and return them back from a polytheistic deities back to a monotheism. And I think Muhammad was right. Though in our day, the version of Islam is not the identical with the version that Muhammad portrayed, but certainly Muhammad was correct in his assumption that Christianity had become intermixed with Greek and Roman mythology. The Christmas day was really the sun pause day, which was the celebration when the sun finally turned and began to lengthen the days. The equinox was on the 21st and 22nd of December, but for 3 days the sun, according to the astronomers in their day, the sun did not lengthen until 3 days later, so you add 22 and 3 and you get 25. That's December 25th. That was a celebration of Christmas because they'd lost track of when Christ was born. He was obviously born in the spring, and he was born in 7 BC, and he died in 33 AD, made him 40 when he died. But, you know, by the time of the 5th and 6th centuries, nobody who was ever a great man could have lived longer than Alexander the Great and had done as many things as Alexander the Great. So they could not let Jesus be older than 33 because Alexander the Great died when he was 33. Jesus couldn't be older than that because he was greater than Alexander the Great.
Good point. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hello, George. Hello, Mr. Kimball. This is John in Kansas City.
Hi, John. Must be listening on KCMO.
That I am. First of all, I'd like to say that the Apostle Paul warned against the talk of the bloodline because he knew that the talk of the bloodline was a lie that kings invented. But anyway, that was just a secondary thing.
Paul never met Christ, if you notice, and he was not one of the original apostles.
He met Christ in the spiritual body.
Pardon?
In the spiritual body.
Well, so have I, and so have you. I don't want to belittle Paul, but to be honest with you, Paul dominates the New Testament for one reason and one reason only, and that was that he was a missionary to Rome. Why in the world did they exclude all the writings of Jesus? Jesus commanded Thomas and James to write and Matthew to write his history. Why are all those documents, without exception, it's banned from the Bible, and all the documents of Paul, with many of the precious documents of Paul were included? And then I have to ask the question, why were some of the letters of Paul included in the Bible and not the rest of the letters which survive in our day included? I mean, this has been a political nightmare from the beginning.
That leads to the question that I really like to ask, which was, well, basically, just because a person lived a long time ago does not mean that they were necessarily a good person or told the truth, and that there was a tradition of using your own writing and attributing it to one of the apostles or another great person in order to give it higher authority. And my question
really
is...
And what document are you referring to in with regard to that?
First of all, the four Gospels were attributed to the apostles, which did not write our four Gospels.
In that case, I'm going to agree with you.
And if we cannot trust people, if we cannot trust that a document is written by the person who said that it was written, can we trust what's written inside?
Good question. I'll let you answer. Unless you listen on the radio. Go ahead, Glenn.
That's an excellent question, you know. If you're looking for absolutes, you're not going to be able to verify that Abraham Lincoln was president of the United States, because there are no absolute documents that he ever existed, you know, in that sense of the word.
And we weren't around to verify it.
Yeah. If you're looking for proof in that esoteric fashion, he's absolutely correct. But, you know, I took 26 hours of statistics, and one of the ways that you learn about truth is by correlational coefficients, which in essence what you do is you try and accumulate accounting for the variance. And a variance there is in documents without doubt. Every manuscript I've ever seen in my life is flawed. I've never seen a perfect document. However, that doesn't mean they're of no value. To discard them arbitrarily because they have a weakness in them, you would have to discard everything that was ever written because it's all flawed. You'd have to discard your newspapers. You'd have to discard everything on television, radio. You'd have to discard every library book in history. There are no perfect documents, including the Bible. I'm sorry. If you're looking for perfection, you got the wrong planet in the wrong era of time.
Glenn, why don't you get that toll-free phone number out again for people who do not have computers, if you would?
That toll-free number is 888-904-9394.
And, of course, www.coasttocoastam.com. You'll link up. You'll see all these documents that and texts that Glenn has been talking about, and two of his associated websites. One very quick question. In all the texts that you are doing, the correlations between the ancient texts, do they all talk about heaven being a glorious place somewhere beyond this planet?
They all tell of a happy ending to mortality. That's why people sometimes are frustrated with me, is because this ending story is not one of gloom and doom and destruction and hell and fire and damnation. The ending story of humanity has a happy ending.
I could go for that. Thanks, Glenn. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure, George.
Very informative time chatting.
We've just cracked the surface.
That's true. You take care of yourself.
I know.
Glenn Kimball. For Steve Carr, Benjamin Pratt, Dan Galanti. I had a little baby with his wife, by the way. Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, the webmaster Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and always Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. Have a safe day. See you tomorrow. Remember the troops.